Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ideas in writing.
Hello, I'm Philip Holden, and this is Ideas in Writing, the podcast where we use words to discuss, words. Words that may be written, spoken, sung, heard, tweeted, misunderstood, thrown away, cancelled, and even delivered to your door on slices of dead tree. I'm really excited this time round that in this episode I got to talk to a bit of a hero of mine, the journalist, LBC broadcaster and author James O'Brien, about his latest book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind. And if you know James from his LBC morning phone-in, you'll know that he has a reputation as a fierce debater. But I think you'll also know that his approach has softened somewhat in the last year or so. So I suppose our chat was quite a lot about what changing your mind actually means. James brought along the word footballification, which pretty obviously doesn't feature in the dictionary I linked to in the podcast description, but it's a word that James has used a lot to describe the entrenchment of positions that seems to be a feature of politics and all kinds of debate nowadays. My word was lies for pretty similar reasons. But our chat was as much about what makes us who we are, and for James, how far he's come from his upbringing, adopted by a loving family with what he admits was the privilege of an expensive private education. We talked a bit about therapy, about dreams, James's dad, and I asked him towards the end if he thought he'd managed to change other people's minds. I'm really grateful for James spending an hour with us and agreeing to sign some of his books for Mr. Books. Two have already been snapped up, so get your orders in. So here we are. This is Lies, Footballification, with James O'Brien. So, James, thank you very much for coming on and spending some time with us. How are you?
Having me. Very well indeed. Cold, but ready for it.
Yeah. It's a bit chillier. And for people listening, we're recording this when all the news of, 30,000 people storming the Capitol building in Washington has come along.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, it's a bit of a theme for me at the moment with Brexit and Boris Johnson and now this. But I don't think that being proved right about stuff has ever felt quite so wrong. But, you know, we are where we are. Astonishing scenes, but again, utterly predictable.
Yeah.
Utterly predictable and all the more frightening as a result.
Yeah, given that you're sometimes in the business of predictions. What's going to happen next?
Oh, blimey. Well, I can't. I can't see an escalation. I think Trump has either been compelled or finally recognized some semblance of normality. So that I think is off the table. I think Biden will be inaugurated, but quite where this anger goes is the problem. I wouldn't like to say it's a massive cliche, isn't it? But the genie is out of the bottle now, and getting it back in, it's going to take more than 4 years of Joe Biden to do that, I think. But you can only hope that he starts making progress as quickly as possible. It's the alienation, isn't it? It's the way that these people are not just unhitched from kind of, you know, winning, as it were, like the old social contract where the American dream, if you followed that path, you got your rewards. That broke some time ago, probably a couple of generations ago. But now they're unhitched from reality. It's the speed and the desire to believe things that are demonstrably untrue that is so fascinating to me, but so hard to predict anything other than Trump's probably finished now. The idea of him running again in 4 years, I thought was quite big as a prospect, depending on his health. But I presume that the resignations that we're seeing as we speak and the events that we saw yesterday, that's got to have taken him and probably, stroke hopefully, all of his ridiculous brood off the ballot papers for 2024. But we shall see. Stranger things
are. Well, yeah. I mean, I think I'm almost immune to optimism now. you know, you sort of, well, you always say, well, it can't possibly be that bad, or it can't possibly get worse.
And then along comes reality.
Yeah. It almost inevitably does. And I think the ability, the sort of shape shifting ability of certain people, and you've had far more experience of these than I have, to sort of repackage themselves, you know, to say, well, that, not even to acknowledge their past beliefs or words.
Quite a few people. I got blocked by Piers Morgan yesterday for
pointing. I noticed that.
Which was a bit sad, actually. I kind of had a love-hate relationship with him over the years, and because I started my career as a show business journalist, I mean... I'm not sure I want to put this on the record for all time, but I'd always sort of looked up to him. And the Trump support seemed to me to be such an epic aberration, such an appalling misjudgment, that I just expected him to at some point acknowledge it or admit it or apologise for it. And a very gentle ribbing of him last night, pointing out that he's been incredibly rude about people like me who were warning that fascism was, you know, being introduced into the national bloodstream in America. Not even that subtly, and you know, the accusations of being hysterical or self-righteous or just plain wrong. I thought it'd be quite easy for him to step down from that, but no, that was a block. And then almost before the protesters had dispersed, Andrew Neil was trying to claim that the only person responsible for what happened was Donald Trump himself, and almost seeking to disassociate himself from the magazine that he's published for God knows how many years. I mean, it is quite incredible to watch, but I guess it may look like a very difficult thing to do to the likes of us, but when you think what the choices are to publicly state, I have made an error of quite catastrophic proportions, and I have supported someone who was all the things that the critics I've maligned for 5 years said he was. It's actually easier to do the contortions and the hand washing than it is to tell the truth.
It is quite astonishing. And I think the other person that you sort of look up to, though it's not necessarily in the same camp as you, was Nicholas Soames. I don't know whether you saw what he tweeted today.
I've seen bits and bobs. I like Nicholas. I don't know that I necessarily look up to him.
Okay. Well,
he is a big chap. I just think it's important, particularly in the current climate, to recognize that no team, if you will, or no political party, more obviously, has a monopoly on either vice or virtue. So I think what was quite liberating about being spectacularly unimpressed by Jeremy Corbyn is that it freed a lot of people who are now called centrists from the tribalism that typifies so much of modern politics on both sides of the pond and beyond. So it sounds odd, but finding Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn almost equally unfit for the highest office in the land was a freeing, a liberating experience.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's important to recognise that people like Nicola Soames, or more obviously Rory Stewart. I struggle at the moment to think of a prominent Leave supporting Conservative who I could muster up much admiration for, but it's a work in progress. And as the Brexit dust settles, I think it's really important to recognise to recognise what we have in common rather than what sets us apart.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's become almost meaningless, that phrase, because it can be tripped out at any point in any debate, in any conflict.
Yes.
And forgotten.
Well, that's the worry, isn't it? Is that if enough people do something in bad faith, then they almost rob the people who do it in good faith of sincerity and relevance. But I think that's a good example. I think that, I would disagree with somebody like Nicola Soames or Anna Soubry about, for example, trade unions or about state aid for businesses or something like that. But it's important to remember that we can agree on things. I mean, Twitter is an awful, awful petri dish for this sort of thing. I love Twitter. I don't make any bones about that. It's a wonderful tool for me, but it's also endlessly entertaining. But obviously I see some of the nastiest extremes on there, and they do come from both the far left and the far right. And it's as if no one... You have to be 100% or 0%. So, you know, if you don't like Boris Johnson, but you also didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, then Boris Johnson is your fault. And if you, yes. I don't quite get it. I've never really felt that way, but I guess any tendency or temptation to slip into that sort of tribal blind loyalty has been removed by the last 4 years of British politics. And although I probably am very, very binary on Brexit, very much associated with Remain, that's not a left-right issue for me. It's a much more complicated and subtle issue than that.
Yeah, I think, that's fair enough. Nicola Soames tweeted saying, "This is your fault, you repulsive maniac." So I thought that was pretty clear.
Did he do one of his super long hashtags?
No, that was it. That was the entire tweet.
Yes, well, he's right. But he's also closer politically to the kind of people that put Donald Trump in the White House than he is to people like me, I guess.
I'm not as optimistic that everyone who ever supported Trump will never get, back to the kind of power that he has, or indeed, want to mobilize that supporter base in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I think he's probably unique in his facility for lying, because the big question for me has always been whether he knew, whether he knows he lies on really obvious stuff. One of my favorite phrases at the moment is to say that's not an opinion, it's just counting. And I think it probably began with the inauguration crowds when he claimed that his were bigger than Barack Obama's, which was just, that was at odds with the most simple arithmetic. It really was. And so, when some of his acolytes and some of his enablers amplify the lies, you know that they know they're lying. When Kellyanne Conway coined the phrase alternative facts, you know that somewhere inside she knows that's a euphemism for barefaced lies. But yeah. Trump seemed to be, to me, possessed of an ability to believe it, the pathological nature of his lying. And whether it rained or Inauguration Day, again, is a great example. Did it rain or didn't it rain? You know that great phrase about what... Yeah. People like me are supposed to do. If one person says it's raining and another person says it isn't, my job is to stick my head out the window and see whether or not I get wet. But he blew that cliche up, didn't he, on Inauguration, claiming it wasn't raining when it clearly was. I interviewed Roger Stone for Newsnight back in the
day. Oh, yeah.
And I actually asked him this. I actually asked him whether or not Trump realised he was lying. As Stone, has got a track record as long as your arm for being a political... choose my words carefully. A dodgy character, a very, he's been to criminalized now, albeit pardoned by Donald Trump. But Stone always gave me the impression of someone who knew exactly what he was doing. So he'd look you right in the eye and pretend to be your friend while picking your pocket. And if he was on a stage, he'd be tipping winks to the audience that the other characters on the stage never noticed. So he was a conscious liar, to my mind. And I asked him about Trump, and he got very cross with me. And I still don't know, but I suspect, if I had to put money on it, I think he believes the stuff that he chooses what he wants to believe, and then he genuinely believes it. And that is what makes him hopefully unique, because even with Boris Johnson, whose relationship with the truth is pretty strained at the best of times, you can see, you know, when Boris Johnson says we will have our cake and eat it, you know that he knows that's impossible. But if Trump said that, I could imagine him sitting down in a tea room and actually trying to have his cake and eat it.
It actually brings me to the very shaky premise of this of this podcast, which is that we each contribute a word, which mine was going to be lies.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Precisely for that reason, because I can't quite decide whether some of the characters that you spend a lot of time focusing on in your book are actual liars, in the sense that we, you know, as you say, they know what they're saying isn't true, but they say it anyway.
Yes.
Or whether they're much more fundamental liars in that they're kidding themselves.
Yeah, it's a question for the ages, isn't it?
And it is.
I'm always at great pains, although it's been a bit of a strain lately. I'm always at great pains to distinguish between what I call the con men as opposed to the con. So.
Yeah.
If, for example, you were to, I just think of the most egregious example, if you're thinking about Brexit or what the European Union can and can't do, I do actually think that people persuaded themselves that the European Union was a genuine enemy, you see. So once you're into that warlike attitude, then you know what they say about the first casualty of war being truth. When you're not persuaded that something is an enemy, and it can be the European Union, it could be immigration stroke all immigrants, it could be Islam stroke all Muslims. New phrases that have had targets painted on their back include lefties or leftists or even woke. You've been persuaded that you're under threat. And that seems to soften the facility for spotting untruths. Once you're frightened, fearful, cowed, then you seem to me to be much more susceptible to snake oil, much more susceptible to propaganda. So I mellow on this as the years pass. I used to get incredibly angry with people for believing bullshit. But I think you've got to work out why they believe it, if they genuinely do. And it's usually because they've had an emotional response to an intellectual proposition. So how on earth can you be frightened of the European Union or think that the European Union is acting against its members' interests, in this case us, you know, or prioritising other members over others? It's completely at odds with everything that they stand for constitutionally and politically. But if someone walks into a room and shouts fire, you run for the fire escape, that doesn't make you stupid.
No.
Now, if it turns out subsequently that there was no fire and that the fella shouting fire, let's call him Nigel, was lying through his teeth, you're still not stupid for running through that fire escape. I think the point at which you become stupid is problematic is when it has been proved to you that there was never any fire and you continue to insist that there was. So it's a very sort of convoluted way of answering your question, I appreciate. But I think if we'd had this conversation a couple of years ago, I'd have given you a different answer. I think there's a lot more there's a lot more believing and repeating untrue things than there is deliberately lying. The problem is when the proof has been provided, you know, and that's when people end up really lying to themselves, which is probably the end game. So, you know, when people started phoning my radio show to insist that they knew when they voted for Brexit that they were going to end up poorer or that they were going to lose their own freedom of movement or that they were going to have more red tape to fill in, when they started claiming that they knew the polar opposite of what they insisted prior to the proof arriving, that for me is my new area of interest, because that that is lying to yourself. And to tie it back to Trump, actually, if I may,
yeah,
I think white supremacism is the original lie, the original sin in these political times, because once you have, and of course, white supremacists believe the lie that their skin color somehow bestows a moral and inherent and intrinsic superiority. So we could talk for hours about why they believe that or why they want to. It's not that hard to understand. If you've been given something completely by accident at birth, it's quite tempting to believe that it makes you better than everybody who wasn't given that completely random attribute at birth. But if you believe the lie of white supremacism, or of English exceptionalism, actually, for that matter, it seems to me once you've absorbed that lie, you've kind of opened a door of credulousness that you can't then close again. So that's why I think you see so much crossover with Trump and Brexit and now the coronavirus and vaccine hoax and skepticism stuff. Once you've fallen for one massive lie, a load of other lies rush in, I think. And again, the people that phone me genuinely believe it. That you can tell by their tone. There's an impatience with me. It's why I've had to hone my craft over the years and find, be more polite, actually, and find calmer ways of questioning people. And it's great fun to beat people up live on national radio. But it's even more important sometimes to understand why they climbed into the ring with such epic confidence. And that is because they believe this stuff. And they've never really stopped to think about it enough to work out why it's dangerous to believe something so silly, so completely. Yeah.
There's a couple of things I wanted to just ask about, whether you'd read Dorothy Rowe's book about called Why We Lie.
No.
So Dorothy Rowe was born in Australia, a psychoanalyst who died, I think, last year.
Okay.
I think this is one of her last books. It's really interesting read. It's not an especially kind of technical psychoanalysis book, but she also wrote something, a book I read quite a long time ago called The Real Meaning of Money.
Okay.
And I'd recommend them because they're quite reflective in the sense that they obviously challenge you to think about your attitude to money or the circumstances under which you would lie. Yeah. And they're always, almost always, about defending yourself, you know, your sense of self, your, you know, the fear that you might mean nothing or you might disappear.
Yes. Yes, that makes sense. And you think of a lie as coming out of you and reaching other people, but increasingly I think of lies as being internalized. It's, you know, cognitive dissonance or double think, whatever you want to call it. The lies we tell ourselves, even about ourselves, seem to be the most toxic lies of all.
Yeah, and when those are challenged in any way, then you get defensive and you get aggressive. You know, and this comes back to the sort of the aggression and violence that comes out when everything you've been brought up to believe, but I'm not even sure it's that straightforward.
No, there's all sorts
of your, going on. Yeah, it's your view of the world, isn't it? Well, somebody's telling you that up is down.
Yeah. Well, or that you believe something and you've not really tried. This is what my new book is mostly about, is trying to work out why, trying to identify things I genuinely believe, things I would look you in the eye and state to be true. And then in the course of my career as a phone-in host, people have presented me with problems that, if I'm being honest, would threaten my certainty. And historically, over the years, before I had therapy, I would come out, as you described, violently punching people at questioning my, verbally obviously, my sense of self. I believe that marriage is the gold standard of all relationships. I believe that obese people have only got themselves to blame for their condition. I believe that these special educational needs are just fancy ways of describing what we would once have called naughty. Now, I have believed all three of those things in the course of my life and in the course of my broadcasting career. I'm ashamed to admit that now because I find all three of those positions so abhorrent and obnoxious. But when I started digging into why I had ended up believing those things, I found the process absolutely fascinating. And I became quite evangelical about trying to help other people
find the tools they need to embark on similar journeys. The problem, though, as you know, and as with so much of modern life, is that the people that would benefit the most from those tools are the people currently most insistent that the last thing they need, the very last thing they need is therapy or indeed tools that would aid their self-examination. It's why all the brouhaha about unconscious bias training amuses me so much.
Because
you have people insisting that they don't need any unconscious bias training without quite recognizing that the reason they think that is because their bias is pretty conscious. I don't need to be taught about racism because I'm a racist. Thank you very much. Yes. This sort of thing.
So your second book, How Not to Be Wrong, I reread this.
Thank you.
This last week.
Yeah.
And it strikes me as a, in contrast to the first book, How to Be Right, it's much more personal.
Yes, it is. It's about me and my mistakes. It's, you know, I have a fairly well-developed ego, as I'm sure your listeners have already noted, but I couldn't have written a book called How to Be Writer or even, although actually the events of the last 2 months probably have knocked the gloss off this gag a bit, I couldn't have written a book called I Told You So. Although that one might still still emerge. So I wanted me to be the guinea pig. So in the first book, it was very much transcripts from my radio phone-in where people would try to tell me that political correctness was a problem, and then I would gently, through a sort of quasi-Socratic dialogue, I would gently prove to them that they didn't even know what they meant when they used the words political correctness and then all the other usual ones on homophobia and immigration and Islam and the list is fairly easy to write. But on this one, yeah, as I say, it was why did you, James, end up believing, passionately believing and violently defending positions that were at best questionable and at worst, I have to, you know, cards on the table, downright wrong and sometimes quite, well, certainly unpleasant and unkind and occasionally quite dangerous. That's what I set out to write.
But it's, as I say, it is very personal. It has a very immediate feel as well, doesn't it? I mean, I read it, as I say, I reread it this last few days and I was struck by, I think you make some reference to the pandemic, which...
Yes. Well, that was a big part of it, you see. It was because I right early on, I had this idea for a book called How Not to Be Wrong, and it was going to be mostly about me, and it was probably going to be a lot more lighthearted than it ended up being. And any aspiring writers out there, this is my most valuable advice, spend the advance, because then you have to write the book. And so I was in that happy position at the beginning of lockdown, where I'd got very, very little on paper, but I had this idea, and I'm blessed when I actually start, I can knock out a fair old chunk in every session. So I wasn't really that worried about missing deadlines completely, but I didn't have a clear enough idea of the book that I wanted to write to get into that zone where I could get lost in the writing of it and suddenly glance at the word count and see that I've done thousands of words.
Right.
But then I got coronavirus myself, but not a particularly virulent dose, and I was broadcasting from the shed at the bottom of my garden at the time, so I managed to stay on air. I'd roll out of bed, do 3 hours on the radio, and then roll back into bed. I barely ate for 8 days, and I didn't have any other symptoms apart from the loss of taste and smell and gastric agony. So it was clear to me that you sit this one out. You don't fight it. And then, and then Boris Johnson got it, and David Cameron came out and talked about how he knew Boris Johnson would beat it because he'd seen him play tennis. And I thought that was such a ridiculously dangerous thing to say, but I realized simultaneously that was very much what I used to be like before I started therapy. So what I'd learned in therapy was that I had spent most of my life, really, probably beginning from being regularly beaten as a schoolboy by my headmaster at prep school, I had put on a suit of armor and I'd existed in a state of hypervigilance, you know, like a permanent adrenalized fight or flight, which turns everything into, in my case, a kind of public school debating chamber crossed with the rugby pitch. And therapy freed me from that straitjacket in the most magnificent and pleasurable of ways. But Johnson and Cameron had a similar schooling to me. I'm younger than them, but I was just at the back end of that post-Victorian public school experience where, you know, privation was privilege, where stiff upper lips were signs of strength rather than emotional illiteracy. And the training that you needed to run an empire involving probably a quashing, a quelling of empathy and a massive prioritization of pugilistic tendencies. I used to be that person. You could hear it on my radio show every day. And that was the key I needed to unlock the book's sort of central message, was realizing that what I had learned in therapy applies to a huge number of people, but has a particular pertinence to the public school educated ruling class. And the more I wrote, the more I realized that it's not that simple. I think that actually being in a gang as a young person on a completely different side of the tracks from the one I grew up on has a similar experience. It's a traumatizing experience. And I would listen to the lyrics of someone like Dave, or I would interview George the poet and what they described. And this was really tricky, Philip, because, you know, on paper, this is asking for trouble, suggesting that going to the most expensive schools in the country can be a similarly emotionally traumatic experience to being involved in criminality and, you know, gang culture from a very young age. But we were frightened. You know, people like Johnson and Cameron and me spent most of our formative years in a state of relative fear, whether it was fear of teachers and authority, and in my case, actual corporal punishment, or whether it was fear of the, you know, the class wit or the class bully or whoever it was. We had, well, what I thought was my skin, what was a suit of armor. And that is what prompted me to start looking at lots. I mean, if I could be so wrong about who I was, what I was as a man, as a human, as a father, as a husband, then clearly it was more than likely that a lot of my, quotes, opinions, end quotes, could be categorically and catastrophically wrong as well. So that's when the book, kind of the planets aligned, and the book from that point on kind of wrote itself.
I admire you putting the therapy kind of front and center of that. You know, but as I say, it's a personal book, yeah, isn't it? And I've been through therapy as well.
Well, then you know, presumably.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to get lucky, don't you, with your therapist? I got lucky first time.
Yeah.
And I went into it, as you know, because I write about this, inexpressible levels of skepticism. I did it because we had a medical catastrophe at home. One of the people I love most in the world was very, very poorly. And I was making things worse by adopting this, you know, jolly hockey stick, stiff upper lip, come on, I'll help you get better because I've seen you play tennis type approach. And so no one was more surprised than me when I felt it working pretty much on the very first session. And that's why people have said it was brave to put it in the book, but it just felt completely natural to me. I've always overshared. I've never felt embarrassed. This is my mum's legacy. My mum's a magnificent woman, and my sister and I were both adopted. That's something that other people might have felt shame about, but I never did. I just felt blessed and lucky. And then my wife and I had fertility treatment because my sperm count was catastrophically low. And again, I'm not remotely ashamed of that. It's a medical condition. It's like having a double jointed or something like that. It's completely random. And I've always been comfortable talking about things that other people might feel shame about. And I think therapy slots into the same category. I'm proud of the work I've done in therapy. I'm proud of the progress I've made, and I'm proud of the person that I'm constantly trying to become. So it was evangelism that made me write about it. I really, really think it could help people to address it. And but again, we're back to that. The one nut I can't crack is the fact that the people who would benefit most from it are the people who would be most, people like me, who would be most adamant that it's the last thing they need, you see. And because I was like that, I think I can say that without sounding holier than thou.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, you made reference to Ampleforth. And goodness knows, they've gone through problems. Last time I read anything about that, they were forbidden from recruiting new students, I think. Yes. But I don't know whether that's still the case.
I think that requirement gets lifted as the appeal against the requirement moves forward. So, you know, I guess a bit like being released on bail pending appeal or something like that. But yeah, it's still a very real possibility. And that could be the end of the school.
But I'm reading a journalist's account of Ampleforth. I think somebody who might have been a contemporary of yours. I don't know. But the thing that struck me was that Boris Johnson would have fitted right in there with a much more lax uniform requirement than Eton.
Yeah, well, I fitted right in. I mean, that's the point. But it's what you make yourself in order to fit in.
So that I guess that's where I'm leading is. Yeah. You know, I think you asked the same question about the guy who phoned you about being in a gang. You know, and he chose a particular path.
That's right.
And again, you know, you have chosen and you are still choosing a different path than people, as you say, like David Cameron or Boris Johnson, who had very similar educational experiences.
Yes, but I had no choice. You know, I would have tried, I think I say in the book, the example I use is coffee enemas. I met a woman at a dinner party once who was sitting there swearing blind about coffee enemas, and which really is what it sounds like. You know, they blow coffee up your ass. And if there was a 1% chance of that equipping me with the tools that I needed to be to be of more use at home, or at least to stop being a negative influence on the situation, I would have tried that. I would have tried absolutely anything, and I hope that gives me a generosity towards people, particularly men, but people from similar, I don't want to say backgrounds because that has a socioeconomic context to it, but from similar origins, when your personality, I mean, they call them formative years for a reason, don't they? Your personality is formed during those years. And I don't think many of us realize that it doesn't have to be permanent. You know, I'll tell you that I wish I'd thought of this when I was writing the book, because it's a lovely phrase that has popped up when I've been doing interviews. It's a bit like living in a house for your entire life, and you love that house, or you think you love that house, and you are familiar with every room and every corner of every room. And then at the age of, in my case, 44 or 45, I discovered it had had a garden all along. And that's what therapy gave me, the keys to the garden. And that, of course, changes every aspect of not just the house, but the life you live, because there's a bloody great garden through that door that you'd never noticed before, you know, or that you thought was permanently locked.
Oh, crikey. It just reminded me of recurring dreams I've had for years and years. It's pretty much that dream, actually.
Is it really?
Not just the garden, but, you know, whole rooms that you haven't discovered.
Yeah.
And I've never interpreted it that way. And I've never been one for interpreting dreams particularly, but
well, a lot of therapy is. My wife got training as a psychotherapist at the moment, her teacher is very big on dreams. It's unlikely that they're completely random, isn't it? They probably do reflect something from your conscious reality in your unconscious. But that I have similar dreams as well. I can't remember whether I had them before, but that is the best way to describe what it did for me. So, you know, even if you're looking at someone you don't like or someone that you're opposed to politically, if you suspect that they're living in a house and they still don't know it's got a garden, if you could help them find that garden, you'd actually end up making them people that you would be less opposed to, because they'd be happier and more at one with themselves, and they wouldn't think that they can, to bring it back to modern politics, they wouldn't think that they would make themselves feel better, as so many of these people do these days, by making other people feel bad. I mean, almost all of the politics of people like Priti Patel seems to be, to me, the idea that we'll make people feel better, we'll make those people feel better by making those people feel worse. And I just don't think that works.
Coming back to your early life then, I mean, your going to Ampleforth in my terms, anyway, I guess it was a pretty concerted effort to buy you this cultural capital, wasn't it? From your dad.
Yes, completely. So dad left school at 15 in Leeds. His mum was a publican, grew up above for people who were familiar with Leeds in that era. He grew up at a pub called the Market Tavern, which was known as the Madhouse, and it was by some distance the roughest pub in the whole of Leeds. So, you know, I wear my metropolitan elite credentials very lightly. But Dad was determined that I would have the golden ticket that he saw other people flash on their way past him professionally. He was a brilliant journalist, my dad, absolutely brilliant journalist, of the kind that doesn't really exist anymore. And he came up via the regionals and ended up on the Daily Telegraph, which for younger listeners used to be a deeply reputable and highly respected newspaper. And he was also a Catholic, a devout Catholic, and Ampleforth is a monastic school. So it was cultural capital, but also, and it took me a while to work this out, and I only worked out after we'd lost him, he also felt that it bestowed, what would the right word be, almost like a hallmark of spiritual strength, I think. He felt, and this breaks my heart looking back, not least because I never had this chat with him, but I've spoken to Mum about it a bit. And I think the religious element of it was what made Dad think they could do a better job of bringing me up than Mum and Dad would have done. Because that's what boarding school involves, like whether you like it or not, whether they are described as in loco parentis for a reason. And I find that absurd, the idea that anyone could have done a better job of raising me than my mum and dad would have done. But I think the combination of the golden ticket stroke cultural capital, the knowledge that, you know, if I was to arrive at the Daily Telegraph with my education, I would have ended up on the editor's floor, on the editorial office. And although people from Dad's background did make that journey, it was infinitely harder for those people. So there was that, but then there was also the religious element of it, which is why what has emerged and what I unearthed while I was there about the men who are monks was so unfair. So, you know, the idea that my ridiculous housemaster, who wasn't fit to lace my father's boots because of my father's experiences, he had somehow unconsciously arrived in a place where he thought that man would do a good job of looking after me between the age of 13 and 18. And in fact, you know, if I'd never strayed a foot away from my father, I'd have been much better off, and I wouldn't have suffered any of the things that we've been talking about with regard to hypervigilance and you know, fight or flight approaches to life. So yeah, it's a funny one there, because also, you know, we've got some great mates, we had a fantastic time at school, and
yeah, very happy, that's the
experiences
thing,
so it's not binary. But yeah, it's a big part of me, actually. And you can't.
Yeah, and it is difficult. I mean, I can tell it is difficult to deal with, and particularly as you say, because it's not that something that you can go back and explore with your dad or with
I think Mum probably. I mean, Mum would agree that that's why I went, and it's why she was less enthusiastic about boarding in general, let alone boarding 250 miles away from home. But it was clearly born of the belief that it would better me. I would be better equipped to make my way in the world. And that's just true for all the things I've just said about it having a deleterious effect on me, and it not, and I'd have been happier and better adjusted and more emotionally literate if I'd stayed at home under Mum and Dad's influence. The bottom line is I got my golden ticket, and at the age of 25 or 26, I was a section editor on a Fleet Street newspaper, which Dad didn't manage in his entire career. So it worked. That's the really tricky thing. It bloody works. I've spoke to Dom Jolly a lot about this on my own podcast, because he had a very similar experience. And the point is that this survival personality, which is what I think therapists call it, which is what I'm referring to when I talk about not realizing that my, what I thought was my skin was actually armor. My survival personality worked, you know, I survived and I thrived, and I wouldn't be talking to you now, certainly with the broadcasting credentials that I've got, if I hadn't been given that golden ticket. Like my idiot housemaster said when I was 14 that I would end up either famous or in jail. by the time I was 21, which was obviously idiotic, but I don't think that I would have I don't think I'd have ended up in jail or in trouble, but I don't think I would have got anywhere close to where I wanted to be or where I have got to without that golden ticket. And that's why, again, it's not binary. You can't say it's 100% good or 100% bad, because the dividend that Dad sought for me has been delivered and then some. And now, happily, I can also separate the good stuff from what I realise is less good or unhealthy stuff.
Yeah, I suppose, as I say, it comes back to this, you know, what in a very crude way, what makes you broadly left-wing after that upbringing, when you could have been broadly right-wing after that upbringing?
I think it's about fairness for me. So there might be areas, and I'm delighted to find myself still capable of changing my mind. There might be areas in which I possibly am closer to being right wing than left wing, but it's more about fairness. It's more about equality of opportunity. And because the opportunities I was offered, because mum and dad could afford just, I mean, they couldn't really, but they pulled it off somehow. They could afford to send me to this school. The opportunities I had are denied to the massive majority of the population. That is just a matter of fact. And again, perhaps because I'm adopted, I have always been conscious of the me I would have been without these opportunities.
Yeah.
And that informs my politics. And what I like about this analysis is that I can frame it as being selfish, because the left often like to congratulate themselves on being unselfish, and they malign the right by describing them as selfish. But here is a selfish justification of it. It's a bit John Rawls' Veil of Ignorance, isn't it? That there is the unadopted me, the non-public school educated me. How would I have made my way in this world? I truly believe I wouldn't have made the way that I have made. So how would you make a society fairer? And that leads me to, I sort of, to be really bloody cliched, that leads me to a sort of Scandinavian social democracy type model, where you still have gaps in society, and I think it's insane to think that you could remove them, and you have a hierarchy, and you have people who are much better off and much better paid than others, but the gaps are much smaller, and the gulf between the top and the bottom in a country like Sweden is a fraction of what it is in a country like the UK, and that's probably the closest I've got to an ideology. And you'd be surprised. Remember, I mean, the religion comes into it a bit as well. I mean, despite the best efforts of people like Jacob Rees-Mogg to completely turn observations like this upside down, you are supposed as a Christian to do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. You are supposed to look after those who are less fortunate than yourselves. You are supposed to care about people. So again, that I don't like to think of that in left-right terms, but that's a big part of what kind of drives me or what keeps me warm at night, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm older than you, but I didn't go to a private or public school. I went to a grammar school. And my parents were teachers, and I felt that I kind of escaped my background in a way, because I moved from Lancashire down to the southeast, and I felt much the same. Mm. It was about, well, if I've had these lucky breaks, isn't it a pity that more people don't get these lucky breaks?
Or at least that the people who've had them don't acknowledge that they're bloody lucky. That seems to me to be the starting point. And that's where the particularly unpleasant brand of modern conservatism concerns me, because there's that great phrase about being the American, say, but he's born on third base and he thinks he scored a home run. And you look at people like Donald Trump's children, and you know that somewhere inside they're convinced that they deserve these baubles and these glittering prizes. And you see it here, I'm afraid, in the particularly the more recent intake in the Tory party. They sort of think they've earned it. Rees-Mogg thinks he's somehow worthy of these privileges, where it's just dumb luck. And it doesn't seem to me to be too damaging to my equilibrium or my self-esteem to say, that was bloody lucky. God knows where I've ended up if I hadn't had that.
But that is an interesting kind of conundrum, isn't it? That you can see that in your position, that it's luck.
Yes.
And other people
just can't.
just don't. Or won. Yeah,
they won.
Or refuse to.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe it's very hard to do because, well, look, I mean, I grew up in Kidderminster, and as I say, my dad was a Daily Telegraph journalist. So if I'd grown up in a castle, I went to school with lads who had moats. So I always used to laugh. I always thought that was one of the great distinguishing. There's rich, there's very rich, and then there's him over there whose house has got a bloody moat around it. But if I wonder whether, and this isn't a catch-all analysis, because some of the most entitled people you can meet are clearly not from this kind of background. But if you are intellectually conscious of just how unfair the advantages you enjoy are, then I wonder how much effort emotionally you put into persuading yourselves that it's not unfair at all, and that there is a sort of natural justice to hereditary privilege. And unless you can convince yourself there's a natural justice to hereditary privilege, how do you sleep at night? You know, I look at someone like, I suppose, Prince William. How on earth does he square his life with any form of commitment to fairness or equality? I presume by never ever thinking about it, or if he, and this is why they invent the divine right of kings, isn't it? Because ultimately, the way you judge, well, no, I know it may look unfair to you, old boy, but this is what God wanted. So tally ho and doff the old cap and bend the old knee, and you know, on myriad different scales, I think that goes on all the time. But it is one of the things that puzzles and frustrates me the most. Why do you find it so hard just to admit that you're lucky? It's a weird.
It brings us back to that that lies, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Whether you're lying to yourself.
Yes, it does. It does. Lying to yourself or self justification. You know, it is it's a very strange business.
Did you ever see the Adam Curtis documentary, The Century of the Self?
No, I didn't, and you're not the first person to recommend it to.
Right. Okay. Well, it's freely available on iPlayer.
Yes.
Like, it's 4 hours of your life, though.
Right, yeah.
But it is it's well worth
watching. You know, there was a reason why I hadn't got around to watching. That is exactly what it was.
Yeah, but it's well worth watching. It's like 20 years old now, I think, something like that. But it's well worth watching, and it does put some of this stuff into a historical context. It's kind of, and I, for whatever reason, I think a lot of this sort of selfish times that I think you mention in the book is because of, I guess, my age goes back to the Thatcher Conservative government and the kind of that idea of popularism and the idea that everyone had their destiny in their own hands if only they had this freedom to
it's a weird ideology, isn't it, when you
it is a very strange thing, and I think it had an effect of I think dumbing down, in the sense it made everything, you know, marketable, everything to be consumed, and
That's a very astute observation, and it's worse now than it was then, I think. I mean, this is the Tufton Street worldview in a nutshell, isn't it, really? Nothing is a means to an end, you know, nothing has intrinsic value. And it's why the education policies that they push are so reductivist, you know, that don't need to study the humanities, don't need to study the arts, you just need to study vocational subjects. Mm. Christ on a bike. It's one of my pet theories, just to get it out there. I think it's in the right context of what we just discussed. But one of the reasons why fascists hate the arts is because of empathy, isn't it? Because if I ever imagine what it would be like to be on the end of that jackboot, the wrong end of that jackboot, then I am probably going to start cultivating an opposition to jackboots. And we learn empathy, I think, from imagination, and we learn imagination from art. So I do think that, I, if you get a few pints inside me, I can wax very lyrical about how all this is linked, and trying to excuse very rich people from having their taxes subsidize the education of poor people. Rich people hate that for two reasons. One, they want to keep all their money. But two, an educated population probably at some point is going to object to the amount of money that fella has got in the first place and insist that he just shares a bit more. Not that he gets strung up from the nearest lamppost, or, you know, this is why they have to try to conflate Black Lives Matter with Marxism. That's all bollocks. But just to share more. And you know, and I know that some people really, really hate sharing. However much they've got, some people hate sharing. Some people haven't got a pot to P in hate sharing, and more obviously and more commonly, people who've already got way, way, way more than they'll ever need seem to hate sharing more than anyone else. It's a great adage, isn't there? It might be Greek. It says if you're ever poor, if you're ever hungry, ask a poor person for food.
Yeah, but I think that reluctance to share, you know, is down to that sort of Thatcherist.
Yeah. The modern incarnation idea of it is, and more recent versions of it are, yes. I mean,
the ideology that your money is your money.
Yeah, yeah.
This idea that somehow it doesn't circulate.
That's right.
You know, the idea that taxes are lost to you.
Yes, it is. This
is a bizarre idea.
Absolutely bizarre. But and also, we don't have the information we need to have a proper attitude to ideas like that, because, I mean, the percentage of people who are net contributors tax-wise to British society is always considerably smaller than people realise. The massive majority of people, I think, over the course of a lifetime, will take out more than they put in, particularly if they're to get a really, you know, if they need a lot of NHS treatment, or if they put kids through state school, then, you know, they're in financial terms, they're almost certainly taking out more than they put in. But once you create the idea that you're being robbed by the tax man, then people who actually benefit from our taxation system end up going to war on behalf of people who, you know, who do resent having to share, resent
the ragged trousered philanthropists.
Isn't it just exactly that, the ragged trousered philanthropists, or the working class Tories, as one of my most assiduous contributors calls them.
I didn't ask you for your word.
Well, we covered it. My word, which I don't think I invented, but I have yet to find evidence of it being used before I started using it widely, is footballification, which describes the process by which everybody is either 100% with you or 100% against you. And your side has a monopoly on virtue and the other side has a monopoly on vice. And I see it, I mean, over the centuries, it's come and gone, but I really feel at the moment that we're in an era where politics has been footballified to a terrifying degree. That people cannot admit any, because what I was referring to when you mentioned Nicholas Soames, people seem to struggle to admit that the other lot have any redeeming features whatsoever. And it frees you from the inconvenience of having to think about things. You just, you know, here is somebody doing something. I'm not going to judge that action by its value, either its moral or its material value. I'm just going to check the shirt color, and then I'm going to decide whether I cheer them to the rafters or boo them into oblivion. And I particularly pertinent to radio phone-in. But radio phone-ins have taken over the world. You look at Donald Trump's mode of politics, it's basically kind of Rush Limbaugh's radio programs where the furious opinion is backed up by little or no evidence. And the phrase I've used more recently is that people have their scarves, you know, it's a red scarf or a blue scarf, and it's knotted so tightly around their neck that it's cut off the flow of blood to their brain, or they just spend their lives biting chunks out of each other. And I'm guilty of it, I'm sure, on occasion, but it can't be good for the body politic, can it, to have a kind of foundation-free, furious allegiance to a flag without really knowing why.
But it's does it have the same foundation as that, you know, creating the bogeyman, you know, making you afraid of something? Or is it?
I mean, it cuts both ways, doesn't it? So it is, I mean, again, this is why I use the word liberating to describe being politically homeless for the last 4 years, because you watched the people that thought Jeremy Corbyn was the Messiah and the people who think Boris Johnson is the Messiah have so much more in common with each other than they do with those of us who find them both unimpressive. I don't know if it is the same as the fake enemy.
No, I wonder.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, it seems to me that in essence, if you look at parliamentary politics, or at least what we see of it, that was always footballification, wasn't it? I mean, the room itself is set up in that way, isn't it?
You had, until 1979, we're back to Thatcher, I think you had consensus politics rather than conviction politics. So, you know, something like Churchill could sit for, you know, all three major parties, pretty much.
Yeah.
You could not imagine that happen. Maybe Chukwuemeka, but you couldn't really imagine that happening these days. I'll tell you what it is. You're right, but it's the other side of the coin. So on one side of the coin, you've got the manipulate this population by telling them there's a barbarians at the gate and I will protect you from them. And once you have got that debt of gratitude for being protected, then you will believe whatever this snake oil salesman tells you or sells you. That's your sort of Trump Farage model. But the other side of the coin, and this is what you're alluding to, would be the security you get from feeling that you belong, you know, feeling that you're in it. So that's why I have no idea what people mean when they talk about leftists and Marxists in the context of Black Lives Matter. They certainly don't mean anything that's in Das Kapital or in the Communist Party manifesto or anything like that. But they don't ever stop to think what it describes. They derive security from perceived solidarity. So it's not so much the confected enemy, it's more the confected allegiances that make people, and that's what social media has done. It's created huge cohorts of people who feel that they're at home, they're in their gang, they're in their tribe, but it's an allegiance built on bollocks. And that is why my first book was so successful at tugging the threads of these loyalties and tugging the threads of these allegiances and demonstrating that they were built on nothing at all. Absolutely nothing, built on vacuums. And yet that doesn't, until someone really holds up the mirror to you, that doesn't stop you from deriving comfort, deriving security from that false sense of solidarity.
And that is more than political, isn't it? I mean, it's the othering of, I think the last issue in the book is about attitudes towards trans people and their rights. And that's phenomenally difficult. I mean, I find that difficult to...
Yes, it's difficult, that's the middle, isn't it? Because... Yeah. For the people who are, you know, at the two, I don't want to say extremes, but I can't think of a better word. It's the easiest decision in the world. They really are. We have all virtue here and the other side has all vice. And they're equally convinced of it to the point where if you're sitting in the middle, like the umpire at Wimbledon, and you say, oh, crikey, yeah, I can see why you might think that. Oh, hang on a minute. Why you might think that as well. You will, and I know this from bitter personal experience, you will come under unforgiving attack from both of them. They'll take time off from attacking each other to turn on you in the middle saying, "That I get that. Oh, hang on, I also get that." And they really hate that more sometimes, it seems, than they hate each other because... Well, I don't know why, but you're right. It's the best example, probably. And then trans really upsets me, the trans debate, because it is being hijacked by much more traditional bigots, you know, people pretending that because someone perceived as having been transphobic has been banned from a university appearance, then that they've very successfully co-opted that reality, that genuine reality, into claiming that other people are being silenced and cancelled as well. So, you know, you're racist and you're homophobes and you're Islamophobes and you're anti-Semites all get some cover from the trans debate. You know, I know what people mean when they talk about cancel culture, but in my experience, it only really has any validity in the context of the transgender debate the desperation that racists have to claim that they are being treated similarly is very sinister to me.
Yeah. It's an odd, you spend a lot of your time trying to deal with these things. Do you feel you've made progress?
I know I've made progress, but I also know that I haven't made as much as I could have done or would have liked to do. Obviously, by far the most gratifying communications I get, sometimes on air this will happen, but more often off air, are from people who thank me for changing their views or changing their worlds, changing their family, you know, family. But I go back years now. Possibly the first one ever was a fella who got in touch to thank me for talking about homophobia and having homophobes on the radio, because his nephew had come out as gay. His brother, the lad's dad, really couldn't cope with it. And this fellow got in touch with me to say, I used what I learned from listening to your show to talk my brother round, and he's now much more at peace with his son's sexuality than he ever would have been if I had never listened to your show. And, you know, I don't want to sound self-congratulatory, but that I don't think you can do much more in life than bring people together like that. I don't think I've ever been prouder of anything. And I get it. I've had a lot of ex-EDL people get in touch. Even just, you know, something as simple as an old boy putting his laptop away at his wife's behest, just saying, you're angry all the time. Just put the laptop under the sofa for a month. And he said, you know, after a week, James, everything was tickety-boo. Everything was back to normal. So I definitely make a difference. And I don't feel self-conscious or pompous saying that, but you'll never really know how much. The other difference you make is, of course, comforting people who were already in a similar place to you. And the weirdest thing about the British media, and there's no false modesty here on my part, the weirdest thing is that there are so few people doing what I do. You know, just being generally kind of touchy-feely, can't we all be nice to each other, let's all get along, and then occasionally unsheathing the sharper blades to deal with particularly toxic positions. But it's a really terrible indictment, really, of the British media, that in terms of those who are allowed to have opinions, if you had to list prominent British journalists whose opinions could be broadly described as liberal and generous, you struggle to use up all five fingers on one hand. Whereas if you were asked to describe people who could be broadly described as illiberal or unpleasant or callous, well, we'd be here all day.
Yeah, plenty of those. Plenty. So is there a bigger audience for you? I mean, is there a place for you back on the BBC at some stage, or is that impossible?
I doubt it. I mean, it's a shame, really. I think in a logical universe, there probably would be. But I left the BBC specifically to talk about Brexit, Donald Trump, and to a lesser extent, Boris Johnson. So I appreciate people aren't quite, not everybody's ready yet to acknowledge that Brexit was not a two-way debate. Brexit was an appalling debate. And I'll say it out loud. People aren't ready yet to admit that I was right about that. A lot of people are. I get apologies in my email inbox almost every day. But clearly what's happened in the last 24 hours means that those of us who used the F word to describe Donald Trump have been proved categorically and completely correct. So you'd think that having had to leave the BBC in order to avoid the false equivalence and the both sidesism on those two issues, you'd think that when both of those issues have been proven to have been the last places on earth where we should have been doing false equivalence and both sidesism, then the door would reopen. But again, it will sound boastful. My numbers now, I've got more listeners in London than Radio 4. So, and way more listeners than Newsnight had viewers. And that's these are relatively recent developments. So I'm not sure there's a bigger audience out there.
No, maybe not a bigger audience. No, I think, but I genuinely don't understand why there isn't a space on BBC for just exploring issues, as you say, in a slightly different way. I mean, if I don't know what channel he's on now, but if Frankie Boyle can say what he says, most of which is very funny, but quite,
he crosses lines
on the nose.
Yeah, absolutely. It's journalism. It's the difference between it. So, you know, there is clearly a bias at the heart of the British establishment. If Andrew Neil can publish The Spectator and somehow observe the BBC's impartiality rules, whereas I have to stop presenting Newsnight because I've tweeted rude things about Donald Trump, or I want to be free to continue tweeting rude things about Donald Trump. Listen, it was never a choice. So I love doing my LBC show. That was my day job. My BBC work was a sideline that I loved doing. I loved presenting Newsnight. It was a right old privilege. But it was never paying my mortgage. So the decision when it came, I can frame it as being very noble and principled. But it was also pretty straightforward in that, you know, this job provides my family's lifestyle. This job is the cherry on the icing on the cake. So you're not going to give up the cherry, are you, in order to keep the cake? And the cake and the icing. So if I was going to knock LBC on the head and wind my neck in on Twitter, maybe I could go and work at the BBC as a presenter again and observe the scrupulous impartiality.
But you would be suffering that cognitive dissonance and you'd be fuming about injustice.
Yeah, you got it. Exactly that. And I'd be thinking, why have you allowed, you know, I won't tell you who it was, but two of the biggest beasts at the BBC. There were little moments, Philip, when I was presenting Newsnight where I would pinch myself. I would think, because, you know, with Dad being a journalist, we had the news programmes on all the bloody time. He used to try to bring off with them mad. I just wanted to watch Trumpton. But
and you were 23.
Yes, exactly that. A couple of the really big boys, you know, they're real legends. And this was just as the post-referendum reality was beginning to dawn. And they both said to me, unprompted, actually, they both said to me, you should keep your voice. And that would have meant not working for the BBC. And I thought that was really interesting. And it kind of gave me the confidence to think, well, maybe I don't follow a career path that has already been trodden by other people. Mm. Maybe I try and map my own. And that is what I continue to try to do.
Well, last question then.
Yeah.
What are you going to write another book? Wow. Is there another book?
I don't know. They're not yet. I mean, I told you so is in the very, very early stages, but I don't know if I'd want to read that, let alone write it. And if I wouldn't want to read me boasting about having got everything right over the last few years, and I can't imagine anybody else would. I've talked about my dad a lot. I always do in conversations like this. We're talking about what made me. And I always, when I was in a career lull, I'd always tell my dad I was writing a novel. And my dad would always come back with the Peter Cook line, neither am I, son, neither am I. So I really hope I've got a novel or two in me, but they're currently notable chiefly by their elusiveness.
Well, whatever you do, I hope it's good for you and it's success. Philip. And I shall look forward to reading it myself.
I should look forward to
it. Even if no one else does.
Writing it, that's the problem. Reading it's the easy thing.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank
James.
You, mate. That really was lovely. That. Thank you.
So that was my chat with James O'Brien as the news reverberated from Washington. I was really impressed by James's willingness to reconsider his position. And as we said in the interview, he's clearly gained such a lot from therapy and reflection. I recommend it for everyone, and especially if you don't think you need it. James's two books, How to Be Right and How Not to Be Wrong, I think are really entertaining and thought-provoking and are probably therapeutic on their own. And of course, you can order them from Mr. Books online at www.mrbooks.co.uk. We've got more great guests lined up. So if you don't want to miss that, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like right here at acast.com. Ideas in Writing is supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of independent, inspiring and imaginative books, gifts and conversation, including, I have to say, an exclusive range of book-related and Mr. Books inspired T-shirts. That's specifically T-shirts. So thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.